Welcome to Dunedin, everybody. Arden Zwelling here. Ben Nicholson-Smith is with me, our producer, Amal Delich. We're down here knocking out some podcasts as we ramp things up, heading towards opening day 2020. Excited to be back on the pod. Excited to be back doing this stuff again. Excited to be around baseball again. I was talking to Joe Panic in the Blue Jays clubhouse this morning about it. We were looking at, they got a schedule on the wall then of like the Grapefruit League games and everything. And we were kind of like, I can't believe that we're only where we are and that there's right. still like, you know, where were you when we were recording this? There's still like 2.5 weeks to go. And we were just kind of talking about how like it feels like spring has been going on forever. And he's telling me about the different waves that you go through. It's short, but it's long.
It's long. Yeah, it is a long time of spring baseball games. Even before the games, there's the preparation. It definitely is a long time. Some would say too long of a time. We're happy to be here. It's always good to be talking baseball, as you said. And it's good to have ATL back because, you know, in the winter, obviously, a bit of a slower time, not quite as often, but we're going to be back pretty much in full force from here on.
Yeah, Joe was like, look, I'm ready today. And we're, you know, we still got half this thing to go through. So I think that a lot of players are feeling that way. But it hit me the other day, just like the excitement of opening day coming around and just learning stuff about this team. Because through spring, like, yeah, you can't really trust what you see in games, right? Like, you know, players will tell you it's a different atmosphere, you know, it's different crowds. You're not quite as amped up. Like, we've seen some of the mic'd up stuff the guys have been doing this spring. And, you know, you see Chris Bryant in the box, like, talking to the commentators. And it's like, all right, how seriously are you taking this? And even when you look at some of the players that big leaguers are facing, you know, you might be coming in to face a, you know, A-ball pitcher from wherever who maybe throws 98 but has no idea where it's going, and you haven't seen any video of them, and you haven't seen them, and maybe you're going in there and you're trying to get to two strikes because you're trying to work on that approach of two strikes. So maybe you take pitches that you wouldn't normally, or you actually take strikes on purpose. Like, you can't really trust the results and the data you get from spring. So I'm very excited for the end of March, for opening day, to actually start learning things about this team.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll sneak up pretty quickly. It is funny, right? It's almost like a different game in some ways, because now there's so much information in baseball. There's so much data all the time, so much video. And so your standard plate appearance in the regular season, you would have batters who know about the pitcher and pitchers who know about the batter. Here in spring training, it would be pretty common, especially once you get past the fifth inning, for guys to be facing players that they are just not familiar with. And of course, you know, maybe in the regular season or a playoff game, you're going to do that research. But you've seen the spring rosters. There's 75 names on these things. So there's no possible way for every player to know every other player. It's more of that schoolyard, all right, like, we're just going to play and see what happens here. And that's fun, but it's also different than how it would happen in the regular season.
Well, even if you did study the guy that you're going to be facing in spring, the pitcher you're going to be facing, like, maybe that pitcher just wants to work on his changeup that day, and he rarely threw his changeup last year at all. So you could study what he did last year when he was like a sinker slider guy, and now he's out here like working on this changeup that you don't see on video and that you're not prepared for, and that he's just going to keep throwing even if he doesn't have great command of it, because he's trying to figure something out on the mound. So yet another reason to be extremely skeptical of spring stats. But look, I've been down here for 2 weeks. You just got down here. I'm kind of passing the baton on to you. Shai kicked us off at .ca. Then I came down. Now you're here. So, you know, I feel like, you know, maybe I'll even just turn it over to you and just ask you what you've been interested in from afar.
Yeah, well, from afar, it's always, you know, the first thing is just seeing those first few photos of, oh, yeah, spring training is actually happening. And when you're at a distance, it is kind of reassuring to see that the players are indeed showing up. They are actually wearing Toronto Blue Jays uniforms. Ryu arrived, all these new arrivals to the Blue Jays. And it's fun to observe that from afar and to read. But you've been down here for a while. You've taken in games. You've seen these players getting used to their new environment in some cases, a new stadium here, or at least a renovated stadium where we're recording this right now. What stood out to you as far as this team and what you're seeing from it?
Let's start. We're looking around the ballpark right now, right? We're watching BP. The catwalk around the outfield looks cool. I haven't been able to get out there yet, but you see the fans out there having a beer, enjoying themselves. It's a better environment here than it's been in the past. And I think the players are enjoying the resources that they have now and just like playing in a bit of an updated space. But honestly, with the renovation stuff and the things that are happening in Dunedin, like the real impact of that is going to be next season when the stuff at the complex is ready to go. It's not quite finished yet, but you look at some of the additions that are going to be made there in like this shopping mall sized player development complex with pitching labs and pools and recovery rooms, like all kinds of cool stuff, like mounds with force plates in them that are measuring, you know, how hard it, that's going to be, I think, the real impact of the renovations. Like some of this stuff here at TD Ballpark, the aesthetic stuff is nice, but I think we're really going to see, you know, just how meaningful a lot of the money that's been poured into overhauling things in Dunedin is next season.
And a lot of it will be hard to see too, because some of it will just be these incremental differences for countless players that add up over time, as opposed to being visible, you know, on day one or on day 15 or 30 of spring training. So, you know, I guess that's part of it. It certainly is a different looking ballpark here compared to what it was in years past. And it's just a bit of a more modern feel. It still has that old school Florida feel, but it still feels like we're in 2020 as opposed to in, you know, 1995, which is kind of what it felt like for a while here. As far as on the field stuff, we're going to talk a lot about pitching, of course, but one question when you really look at this team is the outfield, and right now they don't have a lot of certainty in it. Compared to when you showed up at spring training, do you have a clearer sense of what the Blue Jays should be expecting from that group?
I don't think any of us know, right? You know, Teoscar Hernandez's career has been like such high peaks and low valleys. Minor league, you know, demotions and, you know, months where he's got like 1,000 OPS. And so that's kind of the uncertainty of that outfield. So you don't know what you're going to get from Teoscar Hernandez. Is Randall Grichuk going to perform more like the player the Blue Jays clearly believe he can be? Or is the 2019 Randall Grichuk just what he is? Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who has been phenomenal when healthy and has been really, really good for streaks, but has also had some pretty deep slumps. A bit of that's his profile, that like he's, you know, not the most disciplined hitter. You know, he'll chase, but when he gets a pitch in the zone, I mean, he can get his bat around to so many different parts of it, the barrel of his bat, importantly, and put the ball in play at a really high rate of speed. So like, the outfield and bullpen are like the really big question marks with this team. Like, you got some pretty decent certainty in the rotation. You feel good about your infield, but, you know, add Derek Fisher to that, you know, outfield uncertainty, right? Like, what is he going to show in the majors? What he's shown in the minors? Terrific AAA numbers. Statcast data looks great, but is he going to be able to put it together and prove that he is a capable big league outfielder? There's so much volatility here.
Fisher on the team?
I think Derek Fisher is on the team as we stand now. Like, it's so dangerous, right, to say right now, because like, who knows? As things stand right now, I think Derek Fisher is on the team, and I think Anthony Alford is not.
So Alford passes through waivers, goes to AAA.
Or is picked up by the Detroit Tigers or the Baltimore Orioles. I mean, he just has not shown enough this spring. And like, you and I were talking about this at the end of last year when Anthony Alford's playing time in September was as clear of an indication as anything that the organization, you know, like, soured is a harsh word, right? But like, had kind of figured out that he wasn't making the adjustments they needed to make. And had some other players that they just felt more strongly about. And look, this happens. Like, I understand that Blue Jays fans remember Anthony Alford being one of the best prospects in this organization. And I understand that Blue Jays fans have been hearing a lot about his potential and his athleticism for a very long time. But the AAA numbers, you know, the performance against like upper minors competition paint a pretty damning picture. You know, I've made the case before that if you just do player A, player B with Alford and Fisher, like, it's clearly Fisher is the guy as an organization looking at it objectively that you would bet on and want to go with. If you even do Alford and Jonathan Davis in AAA, Jonathan Davis has not only hit better, but been a way better defensive outfielder as well. So, and Blue Jays fans don't talk about Jonathan Davis in the way that they do Anthony Alford.
Any chance that Davis makes the team?
Probably not. With the bench right now, like, I think Joe Panik's on this team, certainly. You're going to carry a backup catcher, which would be Reese McGuire or Caleb Joseph. So you got those two, plus Fisher. Brandon Drury's going to be on this team. And I think Rowdy Tellez. As things stand right now, and like, look, it's, we've still got 2.5-3 weeks left in spring as we're recording this. Things change. And so often at the end of spring going forward, teams end up just doing whatever preserves depth and whatever doesn't expose them to losing a player on waivers. So if they do see something from Anthony Alford over the next, you know, 2.5-3 weeks, where they say, all right, maybe want to learn a bit more about him and gather a bit more information and see if we can pass him through in April, maybe he comes north with the team because he's out of options. And then maybe that means Atellas is optioned to begin the year and then has to start at AAA Buffalo. Brandon Drury also has options. But you know, you asked about Jonathan Davis. Like, I don't see room for him to come north. But you know, I wonder if he's higher on the outfield depth chart than maybe we sometimes give him credit for, because he really is a good defender in the outfield. Among Blue Jays 40-man outfielders, he's got to be the best defender. And at a certain point, that might be something the Blue Jays prioritize.
Absolutely. I mean, especially when you have Teoscar Hernandez, not known for his defense. You've got Lourdes Gurriel Jr., who has flashed really well at times, but not an experienced outfielder. And Randall Grichuk, whose primary position will be center field this year, but hasn't been in the past. So that does leave room for a really good defensive outfielder, if you can find one. One kind of interesting wrinkle with this is, you know, when you look at Anthony Alford and his potential spot on this team, like, at a certain point, his 40-man roster spot becomes valuable too, right? Because they're going to have to clear spots for a guy like Joe Panik, potentially some relievers who are going to be on this team. So when you have to add those guys, someone's coming off. And Alford, Sean Reed Foley, I mean, these are guys who might conceivably lose those spots.
Yeah, even think about, you're going to need a spot for Nate Pearson at some point this season. If he continues pitching the way that he has, like, that point may come in late April, early May. So, you know, like, the Anthony Alford decision, like, it's not just one that's going to happen at the end of spring. You know, this debate, like, it's going to be a debate going through the season as the Blue Jays need room on their roster. And the thing about kind of the overhaul that we've seen with the Blue Jays 40-man and organization from a greater perspective over the last couple of years is that you no longer have, like, those Breivik Valeras, you know, like, you no longer have Edwin Jacksons. Like, you look around this 40-man roster, you look at the players you're seeing in spring, there's no, like, journeyman, like, retreads, like, we're taking a shot on him, we'll see what he can do, came off waivers type of dudes. It's mostly, on this 40-man roster, young players who you've developed or you've identified from other organizations that you feel strongly about. So those decisions for 40-man roster spots are more difficult.
Just think about how often you see the Blue Jays make a waiver claim. It's not that often, right? It doesn't happen that frequently. And I think the reason for that is they like the group that they have. And that's a contrast between where they've been in years past. So there is a stronger group here. Still a lot of work to do. Now, you mentioned Nate Pearson. We're going to spend some time talking about him and the upcoming decision that the Blue Jays have there. But I want to stick with the position players for now. You kind of broke down the bench there, and I think that makes sense. But Vlad Guerrero Jr. is arguably the face of this team. You know, either it's him or Bo Bichette, a huge, huge part of this team going forward. So Vladdy was tasked this offseason with getting in better shape. He was very intent on getting himself into a stronger physical condition, into a spot where he could show up and be in better shape. So what have you seen from him on that front? You've seen a lot more than I have defensively, behind the scenes, offensively. Where's he at?
He had a good offseason is what I know. I don't know his body composition measurements. Like, I haven't broken out the calibers.
Right.
He, you know, he told me that he's around 15 to 20 pounds lighter than he was last year. But, you know, even just overall body weight isn't the best measure of, you know, your body composition. Like, I've kind of made this point before, but you can be, you know, 6'1", 235 pounds with like a 30% body fat percentage and be pretty out of shape. Or you could be 6'1", 235 pounds with like a 12% body fat percentage and be in pretty good shape. He's just carrying a lot more of that weight in muscle. Vlad definitely looks broader in the shoulders, I will say. And like, I think he's added a fair amount of muscle, like, up top in the upper back. he's been working out diligently this off season. You know, he was down here in Dunedin quite a bit, working out here with Scott Weberg, who is the Blue Jays head of strength and conditioning. And he was taking ground balls from Danny Solano, who's an infield coordinator. That was a lot of his off season. You know, when he went on vacation to Puerto Rico for a few weeks, he actually called up, this is Vlad, called up Louis Rivera, who we know lives in Puerto Rico, and was like, hey, can you come hit me some ground balls? I want to keep working at this stuff. So he did a lot of work this offseason. I think he did a lot more work than he has in prior off seasons. So that's good. I think that when Blue Jays fans see him in the uniform on opening day, they're not going to say, oh, it's a transformation. You know, oh, he looks totally different. I think he'll look pretty much the same. But the true measure of this is just going to be the results and the health and the durability. Because if the Blue Jays are going to be as good as they can be, they need Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the lineup as often as possible. This is one of their highest ceiling players. You can't be having these scheduled days off with him. You can't be having these times where he tweaks something and needs to take a few days off. Like, you need him playing as much as Bo Bichette has been playing if you're going to be as good as possible. And Vlad wants to play that much. He hated taking those days off last year, man. Like, he really, really didn't like it. So that's been a big motivating factor for a lot of this work that he's done, has been playing more frequently and contributing more. We're going to see the results sometime soon.
So this is said with the caveat that he's 20 years old, he's still developing, and nobody on these fields is necessarily a finished product. And it feels unfair to hammer on Vladdy's weight, but do you think the Blue Jays would have wanted him to be a little lighter?
Absolutely. We know that. The Blue Jays made no bones about it at the end of last season by saying, like, he needs to come into spring training better conditioned and in better shape overall. I think just the biggest thing with that is the durability, is staying on the field and being as good as he can be. Like, he did not hit a home run from like the middle of August on last season, and he was playing regularly. You know, and this is a guy who, like, we've seen, like, can put up some rather prodigious exit velocities. You know, like, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but I wrote them a million times last year, where he had something like, you know, 3 of the 7 hardest hit balls in MLB and, you know, 10 of the 25, like the numbers somewhere around there. It's a 20-year-old kid who did that, by the way, who's like putting up, you know, Giancarlo Stanton exit velocities. Like, it's special. It's rare. Not a lot of guys can step in at an age where a lot of guys haven't even been drafted yet and do that. But the overall exit velocity still was not great. The ground ball rate was still too high. And I think it was conditioning. A lot of, you know, it was running out of gas. It was him being fatigued later in the year and not able to put up the type of plate appearances that we know he's capable of.
Yeah, and the pitch selection wasn't there at times. That, you know, that's maybe mental fatigue as well as physical fatigue for a long season for Vlad Guerrero Jr. When we were here this time last year, the conversation was so hyper-focused on Vladdy and what he might be able to do. We're not quite in that same spot this year. It's the tension is spread across the team, but Vlad is still one of the more interesting players, to me in baseball. You could argue otherwise, but I'm still really fascinated by him and what he can do. When it comes to the production from Vladdy this year, what do you think a fair expectation is?
What do you think a fair expectation is?
Honestly, I think it's fair to expect him to hit about 280 or 290.
Yeah.
OBP 360 or 370. Slugging 510 or 520.
So that would be like a dramatic increase from where he was last season.
And I think, oh yeah, let me scale back to OBP. I'll say 350 OBP, 350 OBP, 510 slug, 280 to 290 batting average. Okay.
Right.
So you're looking at like a, you know, we'll call that a 860 OPS. I think he can be an okay, but below average defender at third. We're talking about someone who by the metrics last year was objectively speaking one of the worst defenders, and subjectively he struggled. So I think he can improve on that, but he would still be a below average defensive third baseman. And I think that adds up to being a good player overall. Not a superstar, but a good player overall.
Objectively the worst defensive third baseman in baseball. That's just a fact. And if Vladdy takes some very serious steps defensively this year, like if he improves significantly, he will still be below average.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, he's not a long-term third baseman in my view. There's no need to move him off the position now. But I think that when we're talking about him 2 years from now, I think we're talking about the first baseman, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., or the designated hitter.
Right fielder?
Maybe. I think probably first base or designated hitter. Look, I think the kid wants to hit, right?
Of course he does. That's what he's done his whole life.
Right? And so I don't think it's the worst thing in the world if he just hits. Nobody's going to be complaining that he's not playing third base if he's putting up the type of offensive numbers that you're talking about.
Right. I mean, it is still a big difference when you think about, like, let's pick Nick Castellanos, okay? Because he's a guy who's played third base, corner outfield, and DH, and a great hitter, someone who hits for average and power. So, you know, I think the expectation is that Vladdy will be better than Nick Castellanos, but he might be the same hitter as Nick Castellanos. And if Castellanos had been able to stick at third base, which he couldn't, then he would have been a far more valuable player to the Tigers and then to the Cubs than he actually was.
Yeah, I just don't know that we can kid ourselves about how much potential there is for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to suddenly develop into an above average defensive third baseman. Look, if he works really, really hard, and if he makes some very serious improvements, which at his age is possible, because we like can't remind people enough that he is 20. So they're like, the rapid progression and development that he can make at that age, that's real. Like, you can do it. So maybe, right? Maybe he becomes an average third baseman, which would be he's got a long way to go to get there, but maybe he gets there. Then fine. Then great. I don't know if that's something that I'm going to be betting on.
Yeah, I think that's fair. But you're right. You know, when you say he's 20, it's like he's as close to the age of 10 as he is to 30. Like, this is a young human being and someone who's still developing.
We talk about Nate Pearson, like, oh, this young up-and-comer. Nate Pearson's like 23. He's like 3 years older than Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who has a year in the big leagues under his, you know, more than 500 plate appearances under his belt already. He's a prodigious talent. And, you know, look, he was an above-average hitter as a 20-year-old in the big leagues last year. There are 20-year-olds who haven't yet been drafted.
All right, so you've dodged my question so far. What do you think offensively? Where would you put
that? What do I think he's going to do this year? I don't know, man. I'm not in the predictions business. Like, it's baseball.
I mean, some would say you are. You have to be, whether even if... Not to say on this one, but we do end up making a lot of predictions in the course of the year.
I need to see fewer ground balls, you know? And like you said, I need to see better pitch selection. Like, when Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is at his best, he is thinking along with the pitcher. He has his own plan at the plate, but he's also understanding what the pitcher's trying to do to him. He's not chasing crap, you know? Like, he's not expanding. He's not getting frustrated by, you know, borderline calls that don't go his way, which we saw at times last season. He is forcing the pitcher to come into the zone where Vlad can use like some really elite bat speed to put the ball in play at a rather high rate of speed. That's what he's doing at his best. And when he's doing that, he is hitting it on an upward plane and not hitting it into the ground. I need to see those signs. You can't really judge a lot of that stuff in spring training. Like, we've touched on it, like spring training results, man. Like, I just don't even consider them just because of all the billion different variables that are going on here. So I kind of need to see like a few weeks of the regular season and just kind of see like what the plate appearances are looking like, because those are the elements that you want to see to be like, okay, like now Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is doing what makes him great. Now he's doing what allowed him to walk more than he struck out in the minor leagues and put up 118, 119 mile per hour exit velocities in the minor leagues. Like, those are the things that you want to see from him.
That's fair enough. That makes a lot of sense. And I'm sure the Jays will be looking for that as well once the season starts on March 26th. Over to Vladdy's left at shortstop, Bo Bichette. Let's touch on him as well. Obviously a cornerstone for this team, someone who had an incredible debut season in 2019. What have you seen from him this spring? I mean, by the end of last year, of course, he missed the very end of it with a concussion, but he had really established himself as an elite player. What are you observing from Bichette here in Dunedin?
So I just said that you can't take too much from spring training plate appearances, but Bo Bichette has had some really cool spring training plate appearances. I mean, he is approaching these things like he would in September in a pennant race, man. Like, the guy is grinding out his at-bats. Like, you know, if he's getting to two strikes early, like, he's keeping that front foot down and he's fouling off pitchers' pitches, and, you know, he's showing really good vision at the plate. Like, the other day he fell behind like 1-2, like battled back in this at bat, like fouled off a bunch of pitches, took some tough pitches, and then just hit like an opposite field triple.
And now Bo's got a full count, trying to get the Jays on the board. It's a swing and a line drive to right field. That's going to be a base hit. In to score is Alford. Davis as well. Panic rounding the bases. He's getting the wave home. As it's picked up in right field, there will be no throw. It's a three-run triple for Bo Bichette into the right field corner. And the Blue Jays are right back in this thing, trailing 5-3.
He is really showing some cool two-strike approach, which is like a really big part of his game, right? It's the way he changes the swing with two strikes. And like, he's not swinging for the fences like early in counts. Like, he's swinging to break windows in the parking lot type of deal. Like, he's almost fallen over with the way that he swings. But then when he just kind of quiets down with two strikes and makes sure that, you know, the pitcher doesn't have an easy out here, like, that's something that, interestingly, usually you would want someone like Bo Bichette learning from the dudes on your team who are like 27, 28. But I feel like the Blue Jays actually want guys like Randall Grichuk and Teoscar Hernandez to learn from Bo Bichette and learn from what he does with two strikes to make your plate appearances more competitive and not have as much bad swing and miss or as many like three or four pitch strikeouts as we saw last season.
It's funny on this team, right? You have a lot of guys who are in their late 20s who don't have great plate approaches, and you have some of the least experienced major league players in this team who have the most advanced approaches with Bichette. Of course, Kevin Biggio is, you know, right up there with your Mike Trouts or Yasmani Grandals, or, you know, really being disciplined and not swinging at pitches outside of the zone. That's incredible plate approach that you see from those two guys. What about the defense? I mean, it's so hard to tell from afar, and I have not been here for as long as you as we record this. So do you have a sense of how this team is going to look defensively? We talked about Vladdy, but how is everyone else going to look?
I think Bo plays every day at short. He's going to get his days off here and there, but like, if Bichette's healthy throughout the year, I think he plays 150 games at short. Yeah. And I think that Joe Panic, assuming he's on the team, which I think he will be, I think he can spell him at short here and there. I was literally just talking to Joe about it today. Like, what even is an infielder these days with the amount of, like, you know, shifts and different positionings and things like that? Like, people will say, oh, Joe Panic's only played second base in the majors. Well, in shifts, he's played on the other side of the bag. Sure. So he's going to be fine. I think Kevin Biggio is everyday second baseman with the versatility to move around. If he has to play a little first, a little corner outfield, he can do that. We saw him in center field one point this spring. He can do that. I wouldn't expect to see that really at all, unless there is, you know, some sort of emergency or a really peculiar matchup situation. But he has that versatility. But I think Biggio plays mostly at second. I think Travis Shaw plays a lot of first. But the nice thing about Travis Shaw is also a pretty decent defender at third base, and he can play second as well. So you got some moving pieces on the infield, some different configurations you can use. But that's going to be important, because with this rotation, like, the ball is going to be in play. Hyunjin Ryu gives up a lot of contact. Tanner Roark, a lot of contact. Shoemaker has strikeout stuff, but he'll get some contact, and obviously Chase Anderson as well. So you're going to need to really, you know, be keen about how you position your defenders and about who's playing where when certain guys are on the mound.
Do you think it will add up to being a good defensive team?
It's got to be better, right? It has to be better. And I think that you feel decent about the infield defense. You don't feel great about Vlad, but I think Bo Bichette's taken some very good steps. It's going to be interesting to see how he is as a defender this year. He's a guy who takes so much pride in it. And actually really does work hard on it, and works hard on his athleticism and his quickness and his range. He's come a long way, man. Bo Bichette's a guy who, across the board, look at what people were writing about him 2 years ago, and it was like, this guy's going to be a second baseman. Maybe the bat will carry him, but like, he's going to be a second baseman. He's going to be an everyday shortstop at the big league level this year, and we'll see what the data tells us about how good he is. But he's not a butcher. Kevin Biggio is a good defensive second baseman. Travis Shaw, a good defender. Joe Panic's a good defender. So it's got to be better than last year. I think the real worry with the defense comes in the outfield.
I would agree with that. I think you've got some question marks there left to right. But we'll see. As you said, the pitching staff will need it. And you've got a lot of pitchers who are going to have a lot of contact. We know at this point basically who the first four starters will be. Before we get to Nate Pearson and his potential arrival to this rotation, I want to get your sense of where things stand for that fifth starter's job, because it's said to be a competition. We've seen Ryan Barucki get hurt. What's your sense of where things are right now?
It's such a fallacy, dude. Like, the fifth starter competition. It's a complete fallacy. look, okay, as things stand right now, Trent Thornton is going to start the season as the quote-unquote fifth starter. And the way a lot of people talk about this, that's just going to be the case for the rest of the year. And the Blue Jays are just going to roll with five dudes, apparently. Trent Thornton's going to make starts for this team. Anthony Kaye's going to make starts for this team. Ryan Barucki, if healthy, is going to make starts for this team. Shun Yamaguchi is probably going to make starts for this team. Hey, I haven't even mentioned Nate Pearson yet, man. He's going to make starts for this team. Whoever opens the season in that quote-unquote fifth starters role, like, it's going to be great for that person to hear their name like read out loud at Rogers Center on opening day, and they're going to get to stand on the line and wear a uniform that has an opening day patch on it. Like, I understand that's meaningful and that that matters to players, but like, this fifth starter competition stuff just kind of like, it gets a little crazy sometimes when you actually look at it. The Blue Jays are going to use 12, 14 starters this year, somewhere in that realm, maybe even more. You know, Jacob Wagisbeck makes starts for this team. TJ Zoik. You know, we saw Jency Diaz make a start last year, right? Maybe Thomas Hatch makes a start for this team. Maybe Patrick Murphy. I mean, there's just so many names. The real competition is for the AAA rotation and the AA rotation and filling in there.
Yeah, and you wrote about that, and there's even competition there. Like, it's not necessarily a stretch to say that, you know, those guys are competing for jobs. Crazy to say. Good place for the Blue Jays to be. But like you said, this is a long, long season. And my sense is that the way the Blue Jays view it across the board is they are trying to make sure that they prepare themselves for the long haul of the season. You know, they're not trying to maximize their opening day roster if that means hurting the chances of this team winning games down the road. So it really is trying to maximize that 6-month window. And I think that, as you say, that probably means we should put less of a focus on that opening day type roster.
Yeah. And like, the real benefit to what the Blue Jays have built by acquiring a lot of young pitching and draft, you know, through draft, through trade, through international market, like really overhauling just the pitching depth in this organization over the last several seasons, is that when disaster strikes in the major league rotation, which it will, like, you know, is, you know, you get doubleheaders, guys get hurt, or this guy needs to skip a start or whatever, like, guy goes on the paternity list, like all kinds of stuff, you're calling upon someone that you feel pretty decent about. Like, you're not calling on 34-year-old left-handed knuckleballer Ryan Feerbend. You're not calling on Edwin Jackson, who had like an 11 ERA in 5 or 6 starts for the Blue Jays last year. You're calling on somebody who is young and has potential and who you've been developing and who in a lot of cases for a lot of these guys already has like major league outings under their belts and who you feel really good about not only putting your rotation for a spot start, but it's like, hey, we might need to roll with Anthony Kaye for 4 or 5 outings here. You feel good about that. So that, I think that's the real benefit of this. You know, the Blue Jays kind of, they're kind of spreading their chips around the roulette table a little bit and like hoping that one of these many young pitchers like takes a jump and takes a leap and says, hey, I can have a career like Tanner Roark's had or like Chase Anderson's had. We'll see if they end up hitting on one of them. But at a bare minimum, your replacement level innings coming from the minors this year are going to be better than they were in 2019.
Oh man, I mean, it should be way better. It should be a huge, huge difference. I think that's one of the main reasons, or for me, it's the main reason that I'm comfortable saying that this team is a lot better and they're going to win a lot more games. Now, it's not going to be 95 wins, but it could be 80. It could be 78. I mean, this should be a much different team. I do want to ask you about Nate Pearson, because I think that he is the most interesting guy in this spring training camp and the most interesting storyline to watch as the season develops, because he is so important to their long-term future. And even in the short term, he's someone who can make a big difference.
The 1-2 pitch, swing and a miss, and a curve ball, down goes Talkman. And Nate Pearson, all eyes on you. You've just blown away the side by striking out 3 Yankees this afternoon.
Fastball at 98 on the outside black, and Brian Reynolds looks back at Will Little as if to say, what was that that I just saw?
1-2. Swing and a miss. Got him with a slider. 3 out of 4 fan this afternoon by Pearson against the Pirates.
Here comes the 1-2. Swing and a miss. He struck him out with a high fastball, and it was not close. Once again, Nate Pearson dominates. He's faced six hitters this spring. He struck out five of them, and he gets a huge round of applause as he comes off the mound.
So let's start off with the obvious kind of timeline question just to get this out of the way. He's not making this team on opening day.
No, he's not.
Right. So do you think that there is a case, like, and I'm just asking this with trying to ask this in a neutral way, do you see a case for putting Nate Pearson on this team opening day?
Yeah, the case is he's like probably the second most talented pitcher in the organization after Hyunjin Ryu.
Now,
and you should put your most talented players in the major leagues.
So how do you view this then? Like, do you think that they should break camp with him?
I'm not in like a position to say I know what's best for Nate Pearson, right? Nate Pearson came into this camp with a very clear idea of how this was going to play out. It's not like, you know, the Blue Jays have, you know, sprung anything on him. He's been a part of this plan, and they all agreed to a plan at the beginning of camp that was going to lead to him starting the year in AAA Buffalo, continuing his development. It's similar to last season, this time last year. The Blue Jays presented him with a bunch of different scenarios for how they were going to manage his workload that season. He ended up picking the five inning, two inning, alternating starts one. That's not going to be the case this year. Nate Pearson's going to go to AAA Buffalo and pitch as long as a starter reasonably would. And this is like a digression, but like it's another thing that like drives me nuts is like the talk about how many innings is he going to throw this year? Like, what's the innings limit going to be on? Well, you know, innings means outs, and you can get an out on one pitch or you can get an out on 12 pitches. So the innings really doesn't tell you a lot about workload. Of course the Blue Jays need to manage his workload. Like, of course he's not gonna, you know, double the workload that he put in last season. Of course that would be silly. But when it comes to measuring this stuff, the Blue Jays are gonna use like 30 other data points before they even think about his innings. They're gonna think about his velocity, his spin rate, his spin efficiency, his arm angle, his slot, his, you know, how he's releasing the ball. You know, they're going to all kinds of objective data that they're going to measure that's going to tell them whether he's fatigued, whether he's carrying something, whether he needs to be backed off. Like, that's why to start the season, like, they're just going to let him go and play it by ear, man, and be flexible and, like, you know, just vary what they do or like react with what they do as far as limiting him as they're presented with things that suggest, with evidence, with objective data that tells them you should go in this direction or you should go in that direction. And he's on board with that. He knows he's going to AAA Buffalo to start the season. I totally understand the argument that, like, if you want to like win as many games as possible, Nate Pearson in the major leagues gives you the best chance to do that. But I also very much understand the argument that still developing, he does not have a ton of experience above AA. He doesn't have a ton of professional experience at all. Every player in baseball, whether you are 22 or 38, is still developing, right? So everybody is still continuing their development and continuing to get better and improve. And obviously Nate Pearson falls into that category. I guess what I'm saying is I see both sides.
Yeah, I think it's undeniable that Nate Pearson would be one of the 13 most talented pitchers in the Blue Jays organization.
One of the two.
Yeah. So that part is obvious. And if the Blue Jays were preparing for a 30-game tournament, like the World Baseball Classic, or if they were about to be in the playoffs and it was just a one-month tournament and here we go, we need to try to maximize our wins in the short term, I think you would have to take Nate Pearson north with you. If you look at it through a different lens, though, then I think it's pretty defensible to keep Pearson in the minors, because if you're looking at it for the 2020 season, if you're looking at it for the next 6-7 years, then you do actually need to make sure that he has the chance to develop. And if that means that he needs to work on the shape of his curveball or the grip of his slider or whatever the case, then you want to be able to do those things at AAA, where the results don't matter as much, where you're able to experiment a little bit more. He hasn't had a ton of chances in the upper minors to do that, certainly not at AAA. So I can see the case that you want to put him in an environment where he can still work on that development. I know the counter argument to that is that you can do that in the major leagues, but it's harder to do against the New York Yankees than it is against the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. I think that that's fair to say.
I'd love to live in a world where like the best players on merit and ability are all in MLB. It's an idealistic world that unfortunately we don't live in. I wish we did, right? Like it would be great, but we don't. We saw it with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. We're seeing it with Nate Pearson now. Although I don't know, maybe you look at what happened with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. in the majors last year and it suggests there was still some development that could have occurred there. Like that might be as good of an argument as any for what you're saying that, yeah, you don't, it's hard to continue developing in the major leagues. And like in terms of having a guy make like a smooth entry point into the majors, like, yeah, you know, you don't want to rush these things.
If Nate Pearson had already had 20 starts at AAA, I wouldn't be defending this possibility. I think if he had already had even 15 starts at AAA, all right, he's had his chance. But he's had what, 4 starts with the Bisons? Like,
I think it's just 3.
3? Yeah. So, I mean,
he has like some like only 32 professional starts.
Yeah. I don't think it's crazy for him to go down there and make a few more starts and try to develop in that environment. Now, service time is a part of that. I don't think it's necessarily a driving force. Of course, if you're a major league team, it would be insane not to monitor the service time of your players. It would also be insane to admit that you're doing that. So teams do it, they just don't admit it. But the Blue Jays, of course, are aware of the service time implications. There are huge financial gains for them if they don't promote Pearson until after the end of April. You know, the specific date kind of TBD, but it would be at some point 3-4 weeks into the season. And that's a factor. You know, when you're looking at someone who just hasn't had those reps in the upper minors, I don't think it's crazy to put him down there for a little while.
For his sake and for every young player's sake, I want them to get to the majors as soon as possible and accrue service time as soon as possible so they can get paid as early as possible.
Yeah.
I want that blanket for every single player across baseball. Unfortunately, the collectively bargained situation is working against them in that regard. And it's a reality of what's happening. We always have to talk about it. But like, you know, especially in Toronto these last couple of years, like everybody knows the reality. Everybody knows the situation. Maybe it's something that gets revisited in 2021. We'll see. I think when it comes to Nate Pearson, he's on a very clear track here to become like a workhorse starter, right? To become a front of the rotation starter. And a lot of that has to do with his buy-in to his own development and his investment in himself physically and everything that he does to put himself in the best position possible to succeed. We're going to have him on the podcast next week. We've already recorded the interview. We talk about a lot of that stuff. Like I think you asked the question, you said, you know, what's your like between outings routine like? And then 5 minutes later, we asked another question, you know, And this is a guy and the Blue Jays are like very cognizant of this and hope that he sets the tone for a lot of their younger pitchers in throughout the system and throughout the organization. It's a guy who monitors everything, tracks everything, loves the data, throws all of his side sessions on Rapsodo, is monitoring his sleep and tracking his recovery. His buy-in is going to allow the Blue Jays to not be as restrictive with him going forward. Like we're already seeing the fact that they're just going to let him pitch out of the gate this year. A lot of people fall over themselves trying to like plan out the seasons for these guys. Like, oh, well, you know, you need to hold him back in April so you can have him in September. And they, you know, you try to like kind of devise these schemes. A lot of times you just end up shooting yourself in the foot because stuff happens in a major league season, right? Guys get comebackers that fracture their ulnas, you know, like stuff happens. Guys go through things, you know, you get crazy road trips and rainouts and double headers, and you can't like scheme these things and say, oh, he's only going to, you know, we're going to piggyback him now so that we have him available come September. You just let it play out and you let him continue developing as a starter and then see what happens. And if you approach something where you're getting some sort of feedback that's telling you that he's fatigued or he's tired or he's carrying something, then you address it and you deal with it. What happened last season was Nate Pearson developed like a groin hip issue, kind of like mid-season, like right around June, came to the Blue Jays with it and said, hey, I'm feeling this pain that's unusual. Like I'm feeling this, you know, thing in my hip groin area. They backed him off, took a couple starts off, addressed the issue, and they came back and was himself again and continued to have the great season that we all saw from him last year. That was instructive to the Blue Jays. They learned something about Nate Pearson there. That this is a guy who's invested in his own health and his own development and isn't going to hide injuries from us and isn't going to try to go out and compete with that issue and not only like probably make it worse, but probably also develop other issues because he's compensating for it. That was big for the Blue Jays. Like, that gave them the trust in Nate Pearson to be able to enter spring training this year and actually devise a plan with him about his development. Like, the process is playing out. Like, I know we all want like Nate Pearson to throw 200 innings in the major leagues like this year, like right now. It was similar with Vlad. We want him up right now. We want him against major leaguers right now. There's a process ongoing and we're in the middle of that process. You have to let it play out, because if it continues on the track that's been on so far, the end result could be Justin Verlander, and that would be a pretty great result, but you can't rush that process.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that the Vladdy example is one that stands out for me, obviously, because this time last year, I was saying, you were saying, Vladdy should be in the majors. He is one of the Blue Jays' best players, and that was probably true. I mean, they rostered Alan Hansen and Socrates Brito, so I mean, that point stands up. But I do understand the fact that Vladdy was not as completely developed as we thought. Not that you have to arrive in the majors as a finished product, but he clearly was not a good defender. And we thought at the time that that was BS from the Blue Jays to delay his service. In fact, he was not a good defender. That's objectively true. So that, to me, you know, reinforces the idea that sometimes these players, as impressive as they are, do require some finishing touches. And so that's going to tamper my expectations for Pearson to some extent when he arrives here. And it, to me, if they broke camp with him, you could justify that. If they decide to send him down for a month and have him come up at some point in May, I think from a developmental standpoint, there's justification there.
Look, Vladdy was ready and he wasn't, because he was an above average hitter at the major league level as a 20-year-old. So he was ready in that regard. He wasn't ready defensively and he wasn't ready from a conditioning standpoint.
Yeah.
And we clearly and objectively saw that bear fruit over the course of the season. Now, if the Blue Jays had held him down until like August, would that have changed? He probably still would have worn down because he wasn't in great condition, right? From April through August in the minors, was he all of a sudden going to develop into a Gold Glove defender? Those things are realities, and you know, you can only develop so much at a certain point. And with Nate Pearson, like, this is a guy who, like, I fully believe is going to be exceptional. Like, I fully believe is going to be really, really good. We do have to remember, we've only seen him in what, 3 innings so far this spring as we sit here today recording this. Like, if he goes out and has a 1-inning outing where he just does not have his command, he's just not feeling it on the mound, and he like walks 3 dudes and hits another, very different conversation all of a sudden, which is totally liable to happen, which happens to the best pitchers in baseball, where they take the mound and they just don't feel their best. I mean, that's why I think the Blue Jays having a plan that they're not going to divert from is actually like really wise and is obvious to people in the game. And it's not so obvious to like a lot of the discourse around the game, but like you don't overreact to 1 inning, to 3 innings, to 7 innings, to 10 innings. You don't let that change your plan. If you set out your plan and there is like very clear reasons behind why you're doing these things, you stick to that and you let it play out. And if you see something that tells you you need to make an adjustment, something objective that tells you that later down the road, you make that adjustment.
Two last points for me on this. One, Nate Pearson, from a conditioning standpoint, based on the conversation that we had with him and that our listeners will hear pretty soon, he is definitely ready. That sounds like someone who is absolutely ready for the conditioning and preparation and routine side of things. And the second point, Nate Pearson in those 2 outings had allowed a home run and topped out at 96. How different is this conversation?
Right. In the Arizona Fall League All-Star game, he threw 104 to Pete Alonso. And what did Pete Alonso do? He put it in the seats. Wow. He took him deep on 104. So they, but like if that very well could have happened in one of these spring outings, and all of a sudden the conversation is completely different.
No doubt. All right, Arden, I want to hear your thoughts on the bullpen as well, because we have not touched on that at all. We know that Rafael Dolis is most likely going to begin the season on the injured list after having his appendix removed. So that's one name that we can cross off, at least for now. We know that Ken Giles will be the closer. Beyond that, honestly, like, I don't know. There's a lot of certainty. I'm looking down the list here. Like, not a lot of names that you say this guy is definitely going to be in the bullpen start to finish.
Even Dolis came with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of volatility. He was great in Japan, but it's, you know, as we've seen with Shunya Yamaguchi, it's an adjustment. You know, it's a bit of a different thing throwing to MLB hitters than it is throwing to NPB hitters. So, and that's like volatility and uncertainty is like the mark of this bullpen, like you said, beyond Ken Giles. Like, I think that come, you know, I don't know, a month into the season, we're going to be talking about this bullpen, like, no matter what. Like, it's going to be a big topic no matter what. It's just, are we saying they didn't do enough to build a good enough bullpen and it's losing, costing them games and this is a big problem? Or are we saying, wow, what a pleasant surprise this bullpen has been. Who was expecting that Anthony Bass was going to be this shutdown setup guy? And who saw coming into camp that Jordan Romano was going to win a job on this team and be throwing 98 with this wicked slider? And like, hey, who knew Sam Gavilio could actually thrive in leverage? So like, I think it's going to be a topic one way or the other. And that's the thing with volatility. Like, you just don't know which way it's going to go. But yeah, uncertainty and like a lack of proven track records are like the way to characterize this bullpen right now.
Yeah, without a doubt. This time of year when we're talking to manager Charlie Montoyo in the morning, and you're kind of, you know, for you guys, been doing this every day for a while. He's been doing this every day for more than a month now. One of the questions that comes up pretty often is who's surprising you, who's jumping out to you. When that question has been asked of Montoyo in the last little bit, does he mention any specific relievers as far as guys who have impressed him?
Honestly, not publicly, right? Like, you know, Charlie, like he's pretty cognizant of like not wanting to gas up one guy in the press and not the other. When you talk to people behind the scenes, Jordan Romano is really impressing this spring. Like, this is a guy who I think took a lot of ownership over his career over the offseason, which is not to say that he wasn't earlier in his career, but I think he's just kind of learned some things over the years. We've seen him over prior seasons, the stuff has declined and the velocity has declined. Think about last season when he came up in June and was like striking out half the hitters he faced and like throwing gas. And then think about the guy we saw in September, where it was like a tick or two below in the velo, giving up home runs, giving up runs, like stuff wasn't quite as sharp and crisp. I think Jordan Romano learned from that. So this offseason, he was down here in Dunedin, working out a lot, Scott Weberg and the crew here, added 10 pounds of muscle. And the biggest thing, I think, is he started using a Modus sleeve, which is, if you're not familiar with it, look it up. Like, it's basically a compression sleeve, little sensor chip in it, just measures your workload with how much you're throwing. Jordan Romano has thrown too much, man, in the past. He's thrown too much between outings. He's thrown too much during the offseason. You hate to fault a guy for working too much, but he kind of learned, like, hey, maybe there's some days where I need to do a bit less. Like, maybe I need to save a little bit more. And I think that's why you're seeing him at 98 this spring rather than like 96, you know, where he was before. And I think that's why he has a better opportunity to just sustain and maintain his velocity and stuff over the course of a season. I think he was in great position to be in this bullpen like before Rafael Dolis went down. I think now the Blue Jays need him and need that velocity late in games and like need his mentality as a setup guy. So I would put him right back there at the back end of this bullpen right now, along with Anthony Bass, along with Sam Gavilio, who's likely to see some leverage this year.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I think Sam Gavilio is going to face leverage.
Really? Wow.
Absolutely. It's not something the Blue Jays have always been comfortable with, yeah. But A, they don't have a ton of options. Yeah. B, I've been told that Sam is throwing it very, very well this spring. I mean, I have concerns over the workload that he's faced in recent seasons, so we'll kind of see. But apparently he's looked very good in side sessions. I think Wilmer Font is going to be, you know, if not pitching the eighth, like, sixth, seventh inning type of guy is going to be back there. Looks like Shunya Yamaguchi is probably going to be in that bullpen as well. And then you've kind of got guys like AJ Cole, Justin Miller, Brian Moran, the lefty, who are kind of competing to round out that group.
A lot of names, a lot of overworked relievers. Some would say that adjective could also apply to Arden Zwelling after 12 days here churning out all kinds of stories.
Buddy, you're the reliever. Yeah, right. You're taking me out of the game.
Is this leverage or is this slop? I don't know. Either way, I'm in the game. That's good. Anything else we should look for from you over the course of the next little while? Obviously, you've got a couple podcasts coming up. Keep your feed refreshed. But you've been obviously very busy. I think Jordan Romano, you mentioned him. You mentioned, you know, any of these players basically that we've talked about, Arden has written about. So check that out on sportsnet.ca.
Yeah. I wrote something about Jonathan Davis's, you know, his wife had a very tough birth that kind of set him back in camp. So you can find that on sportsnet.ca. That was kind of cool. You can read that. Had one on Tanner Roark, which was just kind of, like, Tanner Roark's going to be great for our purposes as journalists, just because he gives really great quotes and is like a really cool dude to talk to. So he gave me some good stuff. So you can see that on sportsnet.ca. Had one on Joe Panik that kind of explains why he's extremely likely to come north with the team. I had one on Nate Pearson, like explaining everything about how the Blue Jays are going to manage his workload and everything about why they're doing it and how it's going to play out. So I would take a look at that. Maybe some stuff coming up on the catchers and how they're trying to take their framing to the next level this season. They're going to need to with this rotation of kind of command and crafty dudes who are trying to pick the corners. It's going to be really, really important that the Blue Jays have good receivers behind the plate. We saw Danny Jansen take some pretty big strides in that regard last season. And there's been a lot of work going on behind the scenes in order to make the Blue Jays even better in that regard. So I should have that coming soon.
Awesome. We will look for that. Arden, thanks for the insight. Keep the feed refreshed on At The Letters. Thanks, of course, to Amal Delish, who is producing this. And we will talk to you soon on At The Letters.